This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends. Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Ruth Todd and Maureen Rout. Today Maureen is talking with Nick Noe, who has just won a major literary award, and my guest is Jennifer Lane, who was the winner of the first published crime novel in the Nio Marsh Awards at the Word Festival in Christchurch in August. Jennifer Lane is a well-known short story writer who's been published on both sides of the Tasman and has won several prizes for her short stories. She feels equally at home in New South Wales, Australia, where she was born and where her first crime novel is set, All Our Secrets. It was the winner of the 2018 Nio Marsh first published crime novel. Congratulations, Jennifer.
Thank you very much, Ruth.
It was great to meet you that night, and such a fun night, wasn't it, for you to be winning the prize?
Oh, it was so exciting, and especially after writing a novel, which is such a long, lonely process, to be able to celebrate the achievement with others and, just feel like part of the writing community was a real buzz.
So you wrote it first as a short story, was that right, and then decided to write the novel or not?
Yes. Well, what I started with was, it was a short story about the narrator Gracie's birth after her mum, Nell, went into labour in Woolworths. She went to the hospital and a whole raft of characters turned up to cheer her on as if it was a rugby game or something. And then I realised that, there were too many characters for a 3,000-word story, so then I just kept going and, And then by the end of the process, that whole scene, I think, was alluded to, but it wasn't included in the novel in the end.
Well, that's what's so delightful about this story, because it's not a heavy crime novel.
No
shooting and going on. Children just disappear. And not that that's more serious, probably, but you set it in a small town where the infamous River Picnic had been held. It was a huge event and only talked about in hushed tones. So
yes.
There's a mystery there right at the beginning, isn't there? What was the River Picnic and what's about it? And you kind of allude to it several times, but more babies were born then in the following months, and not all of them looked like their dads. There's so much little touches of humour in this book. I think that's what I love too.
To begin with, as I was writing, I wasn't exactly sure what did happen at the River Picnic, so that was a process of discovery for myself.
Right. So there's a cult who come to live in the outskirts of the little town, and the locals aren't terribly keen on these people. And we really learn so much from Gracie, don't we? Gracie's the narrator. Why did you decide to do that?
I think I'm naturally drawn to young narrators. I just think it's their naivety and the fact that they only see part of what's going on. And then as they grow, they begin to understand more and more, and that sort of, it makes for exciting storytelling. Whereas an adult, they're probably more likely to tell things how they are.
And Gracie was just about 11, wasn't she, when the book starts?
Yes, when the story starts. Mm. Yeah, she turns 12 during the book.
She's a clever young woman, and she's in a reasonably dysfunctional family, well, a poor family, and her father's, he's quite promiscuous, and to say it the least. So her mother has quite a hard time. She's got twins, Lucy and Gabriel, who became Lucky and Grub. And and then a grandmother who lives with them too, who's a very staunch Roman Catholic. So she didn't approve of the cult. So you get the perspectives from Gracie's point of view of her family, and it's just a delight. I kept thinking this isn't really a crime novel, but then it is, and that's quite subtle the way you've done it, because Nigel was the first to disappear, and you got the viewpoint of how it affected the other children.
Yes, and I mean, I confess I wasn't thinking of it as a crime novel as I actually wrote it. It was about exploring Gracie and her family in a small town, and then how they responded to something traumatic, like a serial killer, essentially. So I didn't actually think of it as a crime novel either, but
it is. It is, and it's a very very clever one, and I can see how you won the prize because it's quite fresh, it's different. And you bring in so much more. I mean, there's so many neighbours, and I had to go back several times and think, who's Mrs. So-and-so? And now, have I got them all in the right order? Because it would have been far, far too much for a short story.
Yes, exactly. That's what I found.
Besides Gracie, who were the other characters who appealed to you a lot?
I do like her brother, Elijah, who is one of the river children, and he sort of has a tough exterior, but he's quite soft underneath, and he's quite a fun, lovable brother. And so when his life is at threat, Gracie really fears for him. He's quite a favourite of mine. But people have told me that they like Grandma Bette the best.
That's interesting.
She's the strict Catholic and kind of narrow-minded in the way that she thinks the believers are crackpots, but then she won't let anyone say a bad word about her Catholic God. But underneath it all, she's a very kind-hearted person who just wants the best for her family.
She really holds the family together, doesn't she?
She does, yes.
Yes,
the parents are falling apart. Yeah.
I couldn't decide who the killer could be. Right till the end, you held me.
Oh, good.
I had to keep turning pages, and I thought, oh, no, it won't be anyone from the cult, or will it be one from the cult? It could be. They weren't here before this all happened. Down by the river. They must know the story of the river picnic. I thought you built up the climax in the last chapters very, very well, because it all happened to come out who it was, and of course I'm not going to tell you, listeners, but it's just so cleverly done, and it's the last person I would have thought it would be, so I'm not a very good detective at all. How did you, we won't talk about who it was, but how did you come upon the person you wanted it to be?
Well, I think that was another process of discovery as I was writing, not quite sure who it was going to be. And then it was a matter of going back and sort of weaving in clues, but being very careful not to make it too obvious, because obviously I wanted it to be a surprise at the end. So just, being really subtle and just dropping a few hints so people know enough about the character. For it to all make sense at the end, but not for them to guess too early.
I certainly didn't. And the other person that I was kind of drawn to was Martha Mills, the Purple People Eater.
Oh, okay.
Who worked in Woolworths when
Gracie
was born, when her mother, had to get to the hospital quickly.
Yeah. And I think she's probably, in my imagination, the sort of person who is likely to fall prey to a cult, because, she doesn't have much going for her at the beginning, just eating cream buns and working at the supermarket. But, by the end of it, she's on the altar, she's assisting the leader, she's really risen in the world. And you can sort of see how cults can suck people in.
Yes, that's right. People like who she was lonely. She had nobody, did she really? They all seemed to scoff at her and laugh at her rather than support her.
And then suddenly she's included and more than included. She's elevated in status. So,
And she's the one who had the vision of the Virgin Mary.
Yes.
There's so much in this book, and you've got to read it because if you like a different kind of crime novel, which I think it is, All Our Secrets by Jennifer Lane, and it's published by Rosa Mira Books. You're listening to Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.
I'm very lucky to catch Christchurch writer Nick Lowe in town, because he's what I might call peripatetic. I don't know if that's a good word.
Thanks, great word.
Nick has just been awarded the CLNZ Writers Award, which stands for the Copyright Licensing New Zealand Award, which is quite a considerable amount of money. And it's for a non-fiction work that he's currently putting together. And so first of all, congratulations, Nick, for getting this award.
Thanks, Maureen. It's a huge honour and a bit of a bolt from the blue, to be honest. You kind of put your name down for certain things with no expectation whatsoever. So, yeah, getting a phone call about 2 weeks ago from Paula, the CEO of CLNZ, I think I swore quite a lot on the phone, which didn't necessarily stand me in good stead. But anyway.
Well, they'd already made their decision.
That's it.
So.
Can't take it back.
Exactly. Now, one of the wonderful things about this, and I'm sort of quoting Tina Makariti, who I've just interviewed in the last couple of weeks about her book, but she points out how few nonfiction books published by Māori writers, because you're Ngāi Tahu, get out there, and that, you know, this is one of the great things about you're getting this award.
Well, it's just wonderful that they're really up for supporting that kaupapa. The book is about the Southern Alps, and it's told primarily through a Ngāi Tahu perspective. But it also, it weaves together, I guess, the two sides of my ancestry. So it's very much a Southern book. It's very much a South Island book. It's very much a Ngāi Tahu book. For CLNZ to see fit to support that, for their panel of judges, whoever they are sitting up in the clouds, to think that was worthy of support is just awesome. I think I feel like it's always great. You know, when I hear about other Māori writers doing well, when I hear about other New Zealand writers doing well, it's always an inspiration to me. Hopefully this is a little bit of a sign if other people are out there and thinking about what they're writing, then yeah.
Well, you're not just writing this book, you're actually out walking this book in a sense, aren't you?
I am. I mean, it was a cunning plan to see if I could get my publisher to pay me to go tramping, but it seems to have worked. The idea behind the book was really, I guess it started from the fact that I knew a lot about my Pākehā side of my family's relationship to the mountains. They're all mountaineers, trampers, hunters, conservationists, ornithologists, a long history of being up in those hills, and we were raised in that. On the Māori side, we were raised in an urban context. I grew up being able to recite you the Treaty of Waitangi and all of the history of our people in terms of the claim and the tribunal, and I guess this was the kind of the family context. But did not actually know our specific relationship to the mountains. You know, we often think of ourselves as a coastal people, but we have a long and rich history in the high country. And I thought, I want to go dig that up. I want to go see what's out there. So made some phone calls, visited some people, went and talked to the Ngāi Tahu Archives Department. Takare Norton there has been a real big help. Helen Brown, people with their finger on the pulse of that really deep history. You know, various kaumātua across the island. And, yeah, the more I learned, the more I realised there are so many stories out there. And the idea was to take those stories and load them into my backpack and take them for a walk. So, yeah, 10 journeys through the Alps, retracing the footsteps of various ancestors, Pākehā and Māori, to look at sense of place. Yeah.
They're pretty majestic Alps, mountains. I did a bit of tramping in my youth down here, and it's just overpowering sometimes when you're there, and you're so alone up there.
Mm.
They haven't been colonised, really.
No, no, they really haven't. I mean, I think that's one of the things that draws us to them. And, you know, I think every New Zealander has a relationship to those mountains, whether or not you go tramping. They're there, they sit on the horizon, they're on our banknotes, they're on our tourism campaigns, they feature in our films. They're such an iconic and essential part of our landscape and our identity. But I don't know if we necessarily pause long enough to actually think, what do they mean? What is their history? How have they been understood through different lenses at different periods of time? And, you know, even just tracing the Pākehā history of relationship to mountains in New Zealand has been fascinating to think about those early settlers who, you know, the primary reason to climb a mountain for the majority of them was to survey land, was to scope out, you know, was there good grazing land over this pass? Was there potentially a good site for a homestead? It was very much that eye for finding, you know, a place to settle, a place to occupy. And, you know, as that shifts, you know, as walking, which I think initially walking was very much about working. It was very much about, you know, we've got all the tradition of the swag men and people going out there.
It was a necessity, wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Didn't have much choice in lots of cases.
Yeah, you've got to find a barn to sleep in and someone to hopefully give you a day's work to see you on your way. But, you know, that shift that happens with the rise of mountaineering in Europe and some of the kind of key figures coming to New Zealand, the rise of the New Zealand Alpine Club, and then, you know, the tramping, the 20s and 30s, walking was no longer what you did for work. You sort of worked in order to get enough leisure time and money to go and walk. It kind of flips it around. And the other, I think the other thing that's really fascinated me is how we started out with the sense that you walk the landscape in order to own it, to make it belong to you. You know, you pace out a section to fence it off, to put in your claim at the land office. And then now we think about going tramping in order to make ourselves belong to the land. So charting this progress within, I guess, the Pākehā history has been a fascinating task to then put that in conversation with the Māori history, because this sort of it works in the inverse. Ngāi Tahu has many inland settlements. We have Kāinga Nohoanga, we have Mahinga Kai right throughout the High Country. There are well over a dozen routes through the Southern Alps that we used in pre-European times and well into European times as well. And the more that push into the High Country and the more that land was taken up on the Pākehā side, the more Ngāi Tahu were alienated from that. You know, no longer entitled to go to those places, those villages, those fishing and hunting grounds, all those traditions stayed alive, but they weren't accessible. So, yeah, a lot of the book, whilst I'm writing about landscape and I'm writing about relationship to place, inevitably it's ended up also being about politics of place. It wasn't necessarily what I set out to do, but when you start looking at wilderness and landscape, you have to start asking these questions of, well, who owns it? And how did they come to own it?
And who's been displaced?
That's it. Who's been displaced? And also who's being put back? I mean, one of the things that's been an absolute joy in writing about and exploring is all of the ways that contemporary Ngāi Tahu are re-engaging with the landscape. We have programs like Aoraki Bound, which takes about 26 Ngāi Tahu and Pākehā out into the landscape, total immersion in history, culture, language. It's also just a gut-busting boot camp, but it's designed to really get people engaged with the Alps and the history in the Alps. Programs like Manawa Ho, which is a similar thing for teenagers, and then a whole range of initiatives just at a local Papatipurunaka level where different parts of the South Island, different hapu of Ngāi Tahu are taking the local people out on bus trips. They're going and walking old trails. They're doing tours around historic sites. So there's a real push to put our footprint back on the land, I guess. To get to go along to a lot of these things, to meet and interview the key people who are running them, has been an absolute privilege. So now all I need to do is actually really put all this on paper. I'm talking about the book like it's finished. Whereas this award is really to support the writing of it. I guess the research is a lot of that is done. So I feel like I have a rough idea of how it's going to come together. But, yeah, certainly putting it all together, actually turning it into a finished product is a whole other story.
Well, that means I can look forward to seeing the finished product and talking to you about it then, Nick. But you've given us a wonderful overview of what we're likely to get, and I'm sure a very tantalising insight.
Well, it may have completely changed in 12 months, you know, once my editor gets his hands on it, and also once, you know, there's a process very much.
Of course.
A big process of talking to all the various people within Ngāi Tahu, all of our historians and our kaumātua, just to really make sure that I'm getting it right, that I'm not putting stuff out there that's incorrect. So, yeah, it could shift in flight quite a lot between now and publication day. We'll
see. That's the joy of it all, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is.
Thank you, Nick, for being in Christchurch long enough to pin you down for an interview. Congratulations on this wonderful award that will allow you to finish and produce the book. And if anybody wants to read some of Nick's published work, he has a collection of short stories called Arms Race, which is out there, and wonderful reading. Thank you, Nick. And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.